Hey everyone, we're back this week with our health series called Hormone Happy Hour that I do with Kaya Perowit, my co-host and co-founder in our business, Bia Wellness. We interview the top experts in women's health, hormones, mindset, sexual health, and so much more. Health is a huge part of running a successful business and having a fulfilling life. So it's my honor to share these interviews that show us how to eat, think, move, and live in a way that is designed to help us feel great so we can build our own empire. Now, let's jump into this week's episode.
It's still so mind-blowing to me that women struggle with more autoimmune diseases than men do. I think actually 80% of cases of autoimmune disease come from women. Women also struggle with more digestive diseases than men do. Obviously, women go through tons of hormonal shifts throughout their life. Being a woman is just the gift that keeps on giving, but truly, it actually is. And we're so lucky to be talking to Dr. Sarah Zahl-Godfrey today, who is just a pioneer in the space of women's hormonal health and now in autoimmune disease as well. And we have such an amazing conversation with her today about the role of stress and trauma in disease specifically for women and how things like burnout and trying to keep up with the Joneses and trying to do it all is actually contributing to a chronic disease epidemic in women. It's such a mind-blowing and beautiful conversation, and we're so excited for you guys to listen to it.
Our guest this week is our dear friend, Dr. Sarah Zahl-Godfrey. She's a Harvard-trained, board-certified gynecologist and clinical assistant professor of integrative medicine and nutritional sciences at Thomas Jefferson University. She specializes in hormone health, vitality, and longevity using precision and personalized approaches. She's a 4-time New York Times bestselling author, and her new book, The Autoimmune Cure, is out this week. It's all about the role of stress and trauma in autoimmune diseases, and we talk all about this and so much more in our episode today. So let's get into it.
I want to start with autoimmune. I heard Gabor Mate once say that 80% of the people who suffer from autoimmune diseases are women. And I want to know, why do you think that is?
I've been taking care of women for 30 years. And so I can tell you from my clinical experience, from tracking the science for 3 decades, and from living in a female body, that women are more vulnerable. Really, it's a health hazard to be female in our culture. And a lot of that is our culture and not what makes us women. So why is that? Number one, women are exposed to more trauma. So we know that in terms of the original studies that were done on adverse childhood experiences. So women experience on average about 10% more than those who are assigned male at birth. And then we go through these sweeping hormone changes. So puberty is what kicks it off. Then we've got pregnancy, postpartum, perimenopause, menopause. And a lot of people think of those as hormonal changes, and they are, but they're also massive immunometabolic changes. So your metabolism changes, your immune system, your innate immune system, your adaptive immune system, they dramatically change. So there's some sex differences. Then there's gender differences, kind of the socially constructed differences that we see between those who are assigned female versus male at birth. And so I would put the trauma exposure into a gender difference. And then there's kind of this culture that we live in, which is not set up for women to be in a state of optimal health. So those are some of the basic reasons. And even when you look at trauma, when you look at people, men and women who are exposed to the same trauma, like wartime trauma, women have higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. There are some major sex and gender differences. And once again, women are at a disadvantage. So that's what we've got to change.
And I'm curious, Sarah, how do you define trauma? I know it's like a wide spectrum, but so many of us, like you said, are kind of living in this. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you define that.
The definition is an overwhelming experience. So people tend to break trauma down into a couple of different categories, kind of the big T trauma, the things that everyone agrees are, you know, something life-threatening, something catastrophic. Having a loved one die, surviving the Holocaust, surviving another genocide, going through the 9/11 terrorist attack. So there are big T traumas, and then there are these small T traumas. And they're more of the things that may not quite measure as high as some of those big T traumas. But what's interesting about trauma is that it continues to live on in your system, in your body. And in some ways, it's not so much what happened to you. It's more, how does that continue to live on in your body? And we tend to focus a lot with Gabor Mate, with some other writers, Paul Conti, about the mental health effects of trauma, kind of the downstream consequences of toxic stress. So we look at post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, disordered eating. And we don't spend as much time focused on the physical effects, the dysregulation that can continue in the body as a result of trauma. And that's where I'm focused. I'm really interested in that mental and physical interface. And, you know, over my career, I've looked at the things like blood sugar and how that gets dysregulated by trauma, by toxic stress. I've looked at hormones. And so when you look at the stress response system and how trauma can make it dysregulated, you can define it as the PINE network. So that's kind of an easy way to remember the systems of the body that get the most dysregulated by trauma. And so PINE stands for your psychology, your immune system, your neurological system, and then your endocrinological system or your hormones.
Can you share about your experience with your autoimmune condition and your healing journey, which I think is a big part of your upcoming book?
It is. Yeah. So I've written quite a bit about hormones and I've written about blood sugar issues. And some of the ways that I've found have been the most helpful for my patients, my clients, and then for myself. And what I realized when I was just tracking through the pandemic, what was happening with the patients that I was taking care of is that so many people with immune dysfunction, whether that's long COVID or getting a classic autoimmune diagnosis like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which I diagnose almost every day, multiple sclerosis, type 1 diabetes. What we know is that the immune system can become dysregulated pretty easily. And for the reasons that we just talked about, the female immune system is much more vulnerable to this level of dysregulation. So what happened for me was that I started to have some vague symptoms, which are really classic when you're talking about autoimmunity. And when I think about autoimmunity, you know, it's where your immune system becomes confused. And this kind of front line of warriors that you have in your immune system start to battle your own tissues. And it becomes like a civil war. And when you think about it, Kaya, between the normal immune system to a state of autoimmune disease, classic autoimmune diseases, of which there are 100 now, there's this vast spectrum in between of autoimmunity. And that's the 7 to 14 years of your immune system just not quite being the protector that it's meant to be, not quite as benevolent as it's meant to be. So what I found for myself as I started to run my own tests and run my own labs to see if I had immune system dysregulation, I had a high level of inflammation and I had antibodies, which are, you know, part of the constellation of what we're looking for, signs and symptoms that go with autoimmune disease. I had anti-nuclear antibodies. So I was developing antibodies against the nucleus of the cells of my body. And that's not normal. And we're not talking about like a little smidge of anti-nuclear antibodies. I had really high levels. And so this got me to start to look at, you know, in functional medicine, we think a lot about a disease like Hashimoto's, a disease like rheumatoid arthritis. And we think, okay, what can we do in the years leading up to a diagnosis to try to turn that ship around? And so that's what I became focused on with my own body. And it, of course, it's not about me. It's about how can we then start to think about the 4 to 6 years that people struggle with mysterious symptoms that no one is putting together into a diagnosis of autoimmunity or autoimmune disease. And how can we help those people? Because it's so frustrating to not get answers when you've got these mysterious symptoms. And we know on average for people who end up with a diagnosis of autoimmune disease, they see about 4 to 7 doctors over years and years. And so this is one of those places where people are failed by the medical system. And so when these things occur in my system, when I see the anti-nuclear antibodies, I consider that a divine call to pay attention and to say, okay, what's going on here? Why the epidemic rise in autoimmune disease? Is it related to the pandemic? Yes, it seems to be. Are anti-nuclear antibodies on the rise? Yes, they've increased significantly over the past 20 to 30 years, just since I've been a doctor. So that's a bit of my personal experience. And then I found through using some of the protocols that I've got in the book, The Autoimmune Cure, I've been able to reverse those anti-nuclear antibodies. So I no longer have positive anti-nuclear antibodies. And I think a lot of it is resolving the trauma that was in my system, the signature of trauma.
I feel like there's so many women listening in who just resonate so much with your own story and kind of what you've seen with patients. And, you know, I'm curious from your perspective, I know you go into detail in this further in your book, but what were some things that kind of have resolved your own trauma?
Well, you know, I've been writing about hormones, cortisol, progesterone, estrogen, testosterone, DHEA, oxytocin, insulin. I've been writing about hormones for 15 years, and those are my bread and butter. In some ways, I've optimized my hormone balance, and my cortisol is better than it's ever been. My estrogen and progesterone, wow, fantastic. I'm so happy with them. And yet, there was a way that I still feel like I had trauma in my body that was affecting my relationships. It was, you know, my cortisol is better, my blood sugar is better, but I still can tell you that when I experience significant stress, like I went through a divorce last year, when I experience significant stress, it still causes dysregulation. And this, I want to really pay attention here for our listeners, because I feel like we're more dysregulated than ever before in our history. And if you look at things like your resting heart rate, the deep sleep that you're getting each night, the total sleep, the sleep quality. When you look at heart rate variability, which is a measure of your autonomic nervous system, that balance between fight, flight, freeze, fawn, which is what women tend to do, the sympathetic nervous system versus the parasympathetic nervous system, which is stay and play. When we look at the balance between the two with heart rate variability, we're just seeing so much dysregulation. So I feel like in some ways, I feel like trauma is inevitable. Toxic stress is inevitable. Yes, you can buffer yourself. You can change the way that you perceive it. But the first step is to really look at how is toxic stress living in your body? Is there a way that you could dance with it that might serve you better, might not have the cost of infertility, hormone imbalances, maybe developing autoimmunity. So in my own system, when I saw these anti-nuclear antibodies and I put it together with the toxic stress that I was managing, I realized I've got to do something different here. And so I discovered that I had not post-traumatic stress disorder, but partial PTSD. And I see this in a lot of my patients, kind of a functional PTSD where it's not, you know, like the war veteran who's got flashbacks and nightmares and, you know, wakes up hyperventilating, but more kind of this low-level hypervigilance that doesn't serve us well. And in my case, I was doing a lot of dissociation, kind of going upstairs, going cognitive when I was facing a problem and ignoring my body from the neck down. And I find that so many people do that. So it came up in particular with a fight with a family member. So I've got this beloved family member and we had a falling out that had never happened to me before, even though I've got pretty high adverse childhood experiences. My score is 6, basically 0 is normal or healthy. Anything above that is high. And when I had this experience with this family member, it was around the same time that we were seeing all these studies come out about MDMA-assisted therapy. So this was work that was driven by Rick Doblin, the head of MAPS. He has published a couple of randomized trials now showing that for people with post-traumatic stress disorder, MDMA-assisted therapy is probably about twice as effective as the standard of care. The standard of care is talk therapy, maybe trauma-informed therapy, together with selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, but those only have an efficacy of around 30%. Whereas when you look at MDMA-assisted therapy, we know that it gets people to a place after 2 to 3 sessions of no longer meeting criteria for PTSD in somewhere around 2/3 to 71% of the people who are enrolled. So to me, that just kind of blew my mind. This happened along with this falling out with a family member. And so I said to myself, listen, I'm in my 50s. Like, the time is now. Like, what am I waiting for? I want to do everything I can to resolve the signature of trauma in my body, the way that it impacts my relationships, the way that it impacts my blood sugar and my HRV and the way that I sleep. So that started me on this journey of looking at, okay, how can I modulate my immune system? And, you know, that's the things we think about: vitamin D, curcumin, resveratrol, methylators, polyphenols, but it's also psychedelics. So psychedelics have a really important immunomodulating effect. They have a really important effect on your hormones going forward, a really important effect on your neurological system. So that's what got me to really address my trauma. And I still feel like psychedelics are one of the most important immunomodulators that we have.
Hey everyone, it's Yasmin here. In 2020, I was struggling with some debilitating health stuff. I just got off birth control and suddenly I had acne, mood swings, breast tenderness, and really painful periods. I tried so many things, but the one thing that worked was something called seed cycling. I know you're probably thinking, seed cycling? What the heck is that? It's a natural way to support your hormones using 4 specific seeds throughout your cycle. The challenge is that seed cycling can be a little complicated to do and kind of time consuming. So I decided to make an organic seed cycling product that is so easy to use. We make it effortless for anyone to get started today. It's called Bia, and it's a super easy way to add something powerful to your diet to support your hormones, regulate your cycle, and bring back balance. To learn more about Bia and join our community with thousands of incredible women all over the world, go to BiaWellness.com, and that's spelled BeeyaWellness.com. And check out the show notes for our promo code to get $10 off your first purchase. Thanks so much for listening, and now let's get back to today's episode.
You mentioned the pandemic earlier, and I'm curious because in so many ways, our modern world feels easier than ever. We have access to whatever, a lot of us, not everyone, but we have access to whatever food we want. We can turn on anything on the TV. We can contact our friends at any given moment. We can get in our cars. We can travel easily. But what is it about this particular time that you think is causing so much dysregulation?
I think it's multifactorial. So number one, the pandemic has led to isolation and being cut off from community in a way that we've never seen in our lifetimes. So people had that during the influenza epidemic, but very few people are still alive from that period. I think it also led to pretty dramatic mental health changes, some of which are driven by the social aspects of sheltering in place. So we know that there's an exponential rise in anxiety, depression, even post-traumatic stress disorder. And then separately, there's data suggesting that COVID infection and long COVID has these untoward effects on a lot of different systems of the body. And I'm not talking about conspiracy. I'm not talking about, you know, I would say, if anything, I'm kind of in the middle of the, I'm in the middle ground in terms of thinking about spike protein and what that does. But we are seeing, you know, there's some data looking at the VAERS kind of tracking of adverse results with vaccination. We're seeing pretty significant increases in terms of autoimmune disease in this period of time post-pandemic. And we're still at the earliest stages of tracking some of these things. And even the way we track autoimmune disease in the US leaves a lot to be desired. So I think the pandemic has had direct effects, and then there's also these indirect effects as a result of how it changed the way that we get together, the way that we commune, the way that we turn to our culture for support and stress management and, you know, the thing that women do so well, which is to tend and befriend. It was really hard to do that, right? Like, we were doing it over Zoom, which leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah. And even anecdotally, I probably know a handful of women who developed autoimmune disease right after having COVID, or maybe they believe it was the vaccine, I'm not sure, but pretty much within 1 to 2 years of 2020, 2021, MS, other different types of autoimmune diseases, which is really scary. And another thing that I've seen you discuss on your Instagram, which I related to so much, is this idea of being able to clear stress. You said you startle easily, and I can relate to that. I used to be someone who would, I would watch scary movies, I would watch dramatic movies, I would cry and I would get over it. And now I can't. I tell my husband, I only watch funny things. I only want to watch silly, lighthearted, funny things with no drama. I want to talk about that. Like, what happens to us as we get older that this occurs, and how can we support this clearing of stress?
Such a good question. So first, let me just validate the point you made about your friends. We know that if you're paying close attention, perimenopause can start pretty early. Like, I started to notice symptoms in my mid-30s. And we know that as you switch from premenopause to perimenopause, there is a dramatic uptick in the number of autoimmune conditions that women face. So this observation that you have among your friends, more MS after the pandemic, I think it's the juxtaposition of a very stressful experience together with a particular time of life, you know, kind of age 35 to 55, and then a trigger. So that could be some kind of toxic stress. And so we definitely see that. You know, I had so many patients that I saw, just like you observed with your friends, who had an MS diagnosis, psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus. So you asked about clearing stress, which is in some ways maybe the most important thing for us to talk about, like to really help our listeners have a sense of, okay, how much stress do I need to clear? And then how do I go about doing it? I think there's a backstory here that's critical to talk about. And that is what has been described as the highly sensitive person. But I feel like in some ways we need to rebrand it, because when I first started learning about HSPs, highly sensitive people, and the work of Dr. Aaron, I think she's a psychologist who founded some of this work and has done some studies on it. At first, I learned about it because I just wanted to be able to speak to these people through my books and through my platform. And then I realized I am one. So when I was working with my psychedelic assisted therapist, this is maybe 3 years ago, I was talking to him about something ridiculous. Like, I was talking about how when people come to my house and they do repairs and they're like drilling upstairs and they're like stomping around in their boots and they're getting my floor all dirty, I go berserk. And I have to like go to my little meditation nook and put in earplugs. And like, it's ridiculous how I deal with this. And he was listening to this and he said, gosh, you sound like you're HSP. Sounds like you're highly sensitive. So he pulls up the Google form and we go through the 26 questions. And lo and behold, I'm like 24 positive out of 26. And he said something so important. He said, Sarah, this is a big deal. This is a really big deal. If you are highly sensitive, and you know, we live in a culture that is not highly sensitive. We live in a culture that is 80%. People who are not sensitive. And those people have no idea like what your problem is. They have no idea why you startle at the scary movies. And to know this about yourself and then to be able to adapt your environment so that you can, he described it with such a beautiful analogy. He said, you know, these people who are not sensitive, they're kind of like dandelions. They thrive anywhere. And then there are people like me who are highly sensitive who are more like orchids. And we need exactly the right light. We got to be faced in the right window toward the north. We need exactly the right water. We need a little spritzing on the leaves and the flowers. But when we get the environment that we need, we bloom and we bloom and we bloom. And we have to be careful not to pathologize people who are sensitive, because evolutionarily, we need people like us. And I don't know if you two are highly sensitive. Like, I don't want to project anything on you.
I think I am based on what you're saying.
Yeah. And the problem is we tend to be pathologized. Like, I was told the entire time that I was growing up and well into my 20s, even frankly, up until last year, I was told, you're so sensitive. Oh my gosh, you're so intense. You're too much. Like, why can't you tone it down a little bit? Like, why is that noise bothering you? Like, you know, there's a way that we get criticized and pathologized. And instead, we need to look at this as an exquisite gift. Like, we were the ones who were kind of looking on the savannah for the threat. We were the sentries. We were the people who could sense things and feel things and intuit things way before the non-sensitive people. So it's an incredible gift, and we want to hold it that way. Now, another thing we know is that, is there a way that highly sensitive people have experienced trauma, maybe more trauma than people who are not sensitive? Is there a way that, you know, we certainly know that when you look at therapy offices, it's about 80% highly sensitive people. Is there a way that people can sense our sensitivity and maybe take advantage of it when we're children? So there's a lot of questions here that are not yet answered, but I think that sensitivity is really important. So then your question was, how do we clear the stress? When you're highly sensitive, you've got to really work on your environment. So I'm here at my house in Mill Valley. I'm surrounded by trees. I go hiking every single day. I get my feet on the land. Like, that dose of nature is so critical for me with the sensitivity that I have. I try not to travel too much, although with launching a book, all bets are off. And what I would really love for our viewers and listeners to get a sense of is, what's the menu that's really going to help you with clearing stress? Do you need to talk to a coach? Do you need to go to a mindfulness-based somatic therapist, like a Hakomi therapist? I've gone through the level one certification for Hakomi, so I really appreciate that particular way of working. Do you need to do EMDR? Do you need to change your community of friends? Maybe surround yourself with more sensitive people who get it and aren't criticizing you or pathologizing you for your sensitivity. Do you need more orgasm? Do you need to change your yoga practice? You know, I used to do yoga every single morning for about an hour, and meditation works a little bit better for me. One of the best ways I've found for clearing stress, I know I sound like an advertisement for psychedelic-assisted therapy, is with psychedelics, with microdosing, with, you know, using plant medicine and developing a relationship with sacred plants. That has helped me clear stress probably better than anything else. And then exercise. I lift heavy. I never thought I would ever say that lifting heavy was regulating me, was creating the sense of balance and homeostasis the way that it does, but it really does. It helps me, you know, when I'm doing squats and I get a sense of my right hip versus my left hip and what's happening to my pelvis, it's super regulating. And then probably the advanced version is to be of service in a way that clears stress for other people, to be a regulating experience for others. And that's called co-regulation, which was initially defined between, you know, mothers and infants in terms of the co-regulation that mothers provide to their babies. But co-regulation is the name of the game. I saw my daughter last night. She's 24. She lives in San Francisco. We co-regulate each other. And I'm very intentional about that. With my partner, I help co-regulate. With my people that I work with the staff that I work with in seeing patients, we co-regulate each other. So I think co-regulation is really key.
I'm curious, can you expand a little bit more on what is co-regulation? So you said you have it with your daughter and staff, and I'm thinking, how do I bring this in my life? So what does that even mean, co-regulation?
So co-regulation initially was defined in terms of nervous systems, kind of the way that you sort of take your deep presence And maybe we could do it right now together. We could slow down our breathing, put your hand on your heart and a hand on your belly, and just slow down your breathing. Like, inhale, expand your belly. Exhale, let your belly come back toward your spine. And this way of being together, of really connecting kind of more slowly, you know, getting the nervous system to settle down, to have a sense of safety, that's what co-regulation is. So a mother does it with the baby, the way that she looks at the baby, the way that she tends to the baby, the way she changes a diaper, the way that she bathes and soothes and touches a baby. But of course, it's not just babies. The way that you talk to, breathe with, soothe your children, the way you talk to, you know, hang out with, the kind of person you are, the breathing you do, the way you talk and process and communicate with your partner, all of these are co-regulating opportunities. So it's kind of like, the way I think of it is, the more sciencey way is that it's social genomics. It's kind of, you know, we think of ourselves as kind of these stable beings, but the truth is, even here on our podcast recording, we are constantly looking at each other and kind of adjusting our nervous system, our immune system, our hormones in response to what we're saying to each other. So the oxytocin signal changes, the cortisol signal changes, hopefully it goes down, the insulin signal changes. And so this PINE network that we talked about, the psychoimmunoneuroendocrine network, that's constantly changing in response to the inputs that we get from other people, as well as what we're putting out into the world. So my hope is, you know, certainly I want to co-regulate you because I really like you both, but also I want to co-regulate everyone that I interact with, whether that's on Instagram or TikTok or people who read my book. Like, I write my books in a way that I hope people find to be co-regulating.
That's so beautiful. I love that. That's like such a wonderful way to think of our relationship with others and how we can serve others. And you had mentioned earlier something in the beginning of this conversation where you said being a woman in this world is, I forget exactly what you said, like a risk factor, essentially.
A health hazard, and, yeah.
Yeah, health hazard. I would love to talk about that a little bit more, because there's so many ways in which women feel like everything that happens with their bodies is just not fair. It's like, how come we have to go through all of these things? How come we have to struggle with our periods and perimenopause and menopause and pregnancy and all of that stuff? But I'd love to reframe it, which is something Yasmin and I are so passionate about. Can you talk a little bit more about what you said earlier? What a world that is set up for women look like?
So I'm just writing the proposal for my next book, which is about this very topic. So I really appreciate the question. It's right on point. I've thought a lot about this because I'm board certified in everything that can go wrong with the female body. And like, I'm tired of it. Like, I don't want to focus on the pathology anymore, because so much of our pathology is related to the way our environment is set up and the way that we interact with it. So when I talk about the health hazard, you know, just to throw in some statistics to support this statement, it's things like we've got double the rates of depression. We've got higher rates of trauma, as we talked about. We've got double the rate of insomnia, double the rate of Alzheimer's disease. We've got about four times the rate of autoimmune disease. We've got higher rates of chronic pain, both regional and widespread. We've got so many challenges that we're facing. And when we try to tease apart, okay, how much of it is our biology and how much of it is, you know, kind of the way that we're interacting with our culture, I think the majority is our culture. So how do we change this? How do we set it up in a different way? I think we need a bottom-up revolution. So I'm calling for the revolution. I think we should meet at dawn tomorrow and start to plan the revolution. And I'm so grateful that you two are entrepreneurs who are thinking a lot about how do we really empower women to not, you know, be satisfied with business as usual. So how do we change it? I think a lot of the messaging that we get, you know, I was really blessed to be on the Huberman podcast, and I love Andrew Huberman. I loved our conversation. But I would also say he's a man. And a lot of what he recommends in terms of, you know, cold plunges and some of the recommendations he makes that fall under the category of biohacking and optimization of performance, those things are well proven in men. And of the studies that he cites, I mean, I haven't done an exhaustive review because he goes through a lot of science. I would say probably 90% of the subjects in the studies that he cites are men. There's just a huge gap when it comes to understanding what's true for women versus what's true for men. So I think a big part of this shift, this revolution that needs to happen, is really understanding what women are up against, understanding that there's a huge research gap and what works for men, especially this biohacking movement, often doesn't work for women. And that then opens the field to start to consider, with women as leaders, what might work better for us. And, you know, one thing I can tell you that I've been working with, I love my Oura ring. And so with Oura, they've got this new feature. You know, of course, I look at my sleep and my readiness every day, and I look at my heart rate variability, and I hope that I got like 2 hours deep sleep because that is what works best for me. But they've got a new feature called daytime stress. And it tells you, okay, so Yasmin, I know you.
Yeah.
It sounds like you've been looking at this. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, oh my God.
Exactly. So it tells you, you know, during the day, are you stressed? Are you engaged? Are you relaxed? Are you restored? And as I started looking at that, I was just like, oh my gosh, like I need to understand, what does it look like? What does it feel like in my body when I'm relaxed and restored? Because I know what it feels like to be stressed. And then that creates this loop of understanding, okay, you know, when I'm meditating, I look restored. When I'm eating the right foods, when I'm finished with a workout, that's when my physiology is really at its best. And so I can start to develop a sense of what that feels like in my body. So in many ways, I feel like women don't need to be optimized or do more. We need to do less. And we need to be smarter about the choices that we make so that we're not just following in the footsteps of these men who are telling us what works for men. We've got to figure out what works for us, and we need to be empowered to do that. And we have to do it together. We can't be islands kind of doing it separately. We have to do it together.
Yeah, I love that. I especially coming out of the last, I would say, 10 years where it felt like we were saturated in biohacking and cold plunges and zone 2 and this and that and, you know, everything that's going on. It does feel to me that there's a movement. Even last year, there was this thing termed a soft girl movement, where it's like living a softer lifestyle. And I was like, this resonates with me. But it does feel like we are getting there, hopefully.
I think we are. I think a lot of women are just feeling like, wow, this treadmill that I'm on that was designed for men, it's not working for me. Like, I'm just not getting the satisfaction that I need. And I think, you know, one of the upsides of the pandemic is that a lot of people realized, okay, I don't want to be in an office. I don't want to be commuting an hour each way. So I think it is allowing us to look at our lifestyle and to think about architecting it in a different way, especially for women. And so I can ask the women, I mean, I like a cold plunge once in a while. There's no way I'm going to do it every day. Like, it feels like masochism, honestly. A sauna, yes. I am down for the sauna. I'm down for a hot bath with some Epsom salt. Cold plunge.
Yeah, which is funny because we just talked to maybe 3 experts in a row who all said women do better in sauna than they do in cold. Like, they just get more benefits from sauna, more benefits from the heat therapy versus cold therapy. And that totally makes sense to me. I know we don't have much time left, but I'd love to talk about hormones if you're game for it, because that's so much of what people are listening to when they come to me and Yasmin. You know, we've been seeing a lot of cases of things like PCOS and fibroids and all of these states of estrogen dominance and poor estrogen metabolism. What do you think is happening that is causing a rise in these sorts of things?
I think the first part of the problem is dysregulation. So we've really been talking about dysregulation since we first hit the record button today. I feel like we're more dysregulated than ever before. And I think women are more vulnerable to dysregulation than men are because our system is just a lot more complex. So in terms of hormone balance, in terms of estrogen dominance, or what I think of as dysestrogenism, polycystic ovary syndrome, fibroids, endometriosis, we know that when you're dysregulated, when you're in kind of a chronic stress response, and for me, that felt mostly like freeze and fawn. That's how I experienced stress until I got smarter about it. When you're in a chronic stress response, you just don't make as much progesterone. You make a lot of cortisol, you don't make as much progesterone. And there's micronutrient reasons why that might happen. There's issues related to egg quality and the age of the eggs in your ovaries that also play a role. But I think the dysregulation with the environment is a huge part that we have more control over. So I think there's a lot of reasons why we're struggling with these things more. And some of them, you know, I just had a hysterectomy for fibroids and adenomyosis, which is where your body is attacking the muscle of your uterus. I mean, how ironic is that, that an OBGYN has adenomyosis and so many fibroids that they couldn't even count them. And I was pretty on my game in terms of estrogen dominance. Like for the past 20, 25 years, I've been taking the vitamin C to raise my progesterone. Then in my 40s, I took Chase Tree. And then I started taking natural progesterone. Like I was pretty attentive to tracking estrogen progesterone balance. But the stress piece still just throws a wrench in things. So another piece that I would layer in here is that when you are facing one of these diagnoses, we want to be careful to decode the messages of the body and to do it in as objective a way as possible. And just kind of calmly understand the constellation of symptoms and figure out, okay, where does this fit in terms of potential diagnoses? And not to feel victimized by them, because that's what's so disempowering. Like, I really don't want for people to say, I've got PCOS, I've got adenomyosis, I've got fibroids, and, you know, I just have to do whatever my doctor says. I'm going to go on the birth control pill. I'm going to get a hysterectomy or an ablation or whatever it is. And yes, surgery might be the appropriate thing, but we want to stay in that place of choice. And we also want to see these symptoms as a call to action, really an initiation, a time to look at the roles that you have in your life, look at the larger spiritual context, along with the medical, along with the physical and the mental and the emotional, and to see, okay, what needs to change in my system so that I can address these things as fully as possible and really stay in my wholeness and not turn my power over to some doctor that I barely know that I see for 15 minutes twice a year.
It's interesting that you say that. With both my aunt and my mother, who my aunt passed away, she had breast cancer. My mom is good. Now she's in remission and everything. It was early stages, but both cases of their cancer came directly. And I know disease does not happen overnight. I know that, but both of their cases of cancer came directly after about a few year period of extreme stress. And they were both, would it be called estrogen positive breast cancer? I'm not sure what the
yes.
Estrogen positive cancer. And it's just, to me, was so clear. My mom had to take care of two sick people who were dying. And my aunt was going through a very, very difficult divorce and a difficult marriage that had ended when her cancer came. And I just can't help but think like that those were the triggers in both of their cases that led to whatever diagnosis that they received. So it's just interesting to hear you as an OBGYN kind of say and validate the stress piece in all of this.
It's critical. And, you know, you're making a point that we all know intuitively, and science lags behind proving the point. But even so, you can, you know, what we know from the work of Alessio Fasano, who's a pediatric gastroenterologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, is that when you develop an autoimmune disease, and some of this I think relates to breast cancer and endo and some of these other things we're talking about, but with autoimmune disease, there's three things that need to occur. genetic predisposition, increased intestinal permeability, so-called leaky gut, and then a trigger. And so I would say this, something similar is true with breast cancer. It doesn't just happen sporadically. There's an ecosystem in which it develops. And you know this from tracking functional medicine, that we think a lot about triggers. We think about ATMs, antecedents, triggers, mediators. So I think toxic stress is a really common trigger. So is pregnancy. So is postpartum. So is perimenopause. So are infections. And so we're exposed to these triggers. And the question is, what are your vulnerabilities? Like, how is that going to show up in your body? How do you develop your resilience to the point where you're more buffered from the effects of toxic stress?
I love that. I think about that all the time. Like, how do you build that resilience? You know, the modern world that we live in as women, we get impacted heavily. Like you said, whether it's pregnancy, work culture, just living like this, I'm always thinking, how do we continue to thrive as women in business, in our personal lives, and not take that upon ourselves? And I know this whole podcast was so many recommendations that you mentioned, but I'm so glad we're talking about this. I'm so passionate about it. And I can't wait for your next book about how we can live in this modern life, because we get so many questions from women. I actually just got an email this morning saying, can I pick your brains, Yasmin? I'm struggling how to like maintain my work and maintain my health. Like, I just want to talk to women who figured it out. And I'm like, I'm still in process of doing that. But I just love everything you're talking about, Sarah. So thank you so much for being with us. I feel like we could do like a part two. I'm excited for your next book, but this was so amazing.
Such a pleasure to be with you too. I love how you're thinking about these problems and how you're helping to solve them with the community that you lead. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Behind Her Empire. If you enjoyed this conversation, it would mean the world to me if you would consider leaving a review or even sharing this episode with someone who might be inspired to create their own empire. To stay updated on new episodes or join our private community, visit behindherempire.com to sign up. We send inspiring and short emails every week to your inbox. I'll see you next week, and until then, remember, you're always in charge of your own destiny, and it's never too late to start your own empire.